Welcome to Nell and Matt's Obsolete Movies, the podcast where we revisit movies from our 20-plus years of collecting films on obsolete formats. Or also known as films from the VHS era, though not always do we watch these films on VHS, but we do watch it on an actual obsolete format. And our film for this episode is The Entity from 1983, and we have it on VHS, getting it from Dusty from Pleasant Dreams Records Garage, actually. We did a huge haul of tapes, and this is one of that huge haul of tapes. And The Entity was a film, I think, it was a garage full of VHS, and we came home with a big old box of it. And I think when I saw The Entity, I had to have it because it was a film that scared me so intensely as a child. Watching it on, basically on TV. We had a couple channels in the New York market that had movies on almost every night of the week.
Yeah.
And so maybe once or twice a year, The Entity would be on TV. And it would just, it was frightening. It was terrifying. It was a lot as a kid. And so, yeah.
No, I agree with you. As a kid, this seemed like a very terrifying film, and the premise is very terrifying with it. And I guess maybe a trigger alert, it involves a woman who is being attacked.
Yeah, so I guess we should explain the plot briefly. So Barbara Hershey plays a woman by the name of Carla Moran, and she is a single mom. The exposition in this film is brutally efficient.
Yes.
We're at the first attack from the poltergeist within the first 10 minutes of the film.
Yeah.
It's brutally efficient. Single mom, trying to hold it together, working, going to typing school at night to get a better job. And yeah, this invisible entity attacks her, sexually assaults her, and... Well, that's the movie. That is the plot of the film. You get to the first attack in 10 minutes. Then she seeks help first from a psychologist played by
Ron Silver.
Yes. The Paul Schneiderman character, who's a PhD student on rotations, who thinks this is all her own repressed sexual energy. She also stumbles into or encounters at a bookstore some parapsychologists who hatch a plot, to freeze the ghost in liquid helium to see if actually ghosts have mass. This is also one of those horror films that has the based on true events kind of heightened, which, again, I think as a kid was really effective to me. This idea that there could be this invisible force that could harm us is... there is something really primal about that premise. There is something really... And this, like, how do you attack or how do you fight back against an invisible force? That there is sort of a radical helplessness.
Yeah.
That if you identify with the Barbara Hershey character,
yeah,
a lot. And it, so it does that. In fact, you know, speaking of like sort of critical reception or what it was like at the time, Martin Scorsese once called this one of his top 11 favorite horror movies. It's one of his most frightening horror movies he's ever seen.
Wow.
Which, I don't know, revisiting the movie in the 2020s?
Well, I will say Barbara Hershey does a great job.
Barbara Hershey is as good as Barbara Hershey always is.
Yeah, so she does an amazing actress, and she does bring, she does make you sympathetic towards the character, and you do end up caring about Barbara Hershey a bit. But yeah, revisiting it, so you know, for me, so the term has been coined later, like it's, as of now, it's called domestic horror, but this is definitely like a domestic horror, right? Like, in this family living here. And you know, you always have to compare it to the other ones that were out at that time. So, like, you had The Exorcist, and then you had The Changeling, which is, like, one of my all-time favorites with George C. Scott.
Yes.
Of course, Poltergeist, right?
Of course, Poltergeist, which was shot in the, we say, the entities from 1983. Shot in 1981, about the same time Poltergeist was shot.
Yeah.
And it was, and maybe one of the things when we get to, the, like, the legacy of this film, there is this real question, coattails, or was it just a case of there could only be one?
Yeah.
Or the fact that, you know, so they were both shot in 1981. Poltergeist came out on June 4th, 1982. And The Entity was released, at least in the U.S., February of
1983. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So, is it stuck in that group? I mean, there's...
Yeah.
The other thing is the competition, right? Like, those are... The stories are all more compelling, and they're
yeah,
like
and I mean,
better.
Poltergeist has better production values. Yeah. Poltergeist has Tobe Hooper. Poltergeist has Spielberg. Poltergeist
right.
has,
yeah,
you know, all of these other things going for it.
And you also have to say, with it being in the 80s, she's a single mom, and
yeah.
she had her children in the film. She has a son with one husband, and then two children with her partner. They never marry. So for that time, it would have been kind of radical to have...
Yeah, and maybe uncomfortable, and...
So I think there was a lot going on with how women were positioned at that time.
Yeah, which, and you think, you know, Poltergeist is a very traditional family. Literally 2.5 children.
Though it is hinted at that they, I think, got pregnant before they got married.
Yes.
I think that's hinted at.
Yes, it is, because his daughter is 16. The daughter is 16 and the wife is 32. So
right.
if you do math...
You do math, you have to realize what happened. So part of it, I think, did get caught up in it. Part of it, I think, is also the... premise of the film.
Also, they're both in California. They're
both
Southern California movies. Yeah.
And I will say, kind of, so, like, it's, you know, because of the time it came out, it's practical effects. And I think the practical effects are really good. So it's,
yes.
like, you know, breathing and like, cold air and wind and sounds and...
Air
know.
Guns on Barbara Hershey's breasts.
Yes.
I think that was a huge... Which, it was funny seeing that, having seen that film so many times... on WPIX, Channel 11, New York, not seeing maybe the biggest, creepiest effect of the film until watching the film as an adult.
Yeah.
Yes.
But there was a scene where she's attacked and her breasts are being manipulated by this entity.
Yes.
And she, they actually made a plaster cast of her body.
Yes.
And so they're using, and so she actually kind of fits into the suit.
Yes.
Into this box, and they actually are using suction cups underneath to make it look
yes.
like her breasts are being pressed down. As a, like, though, you're right, it was heavy, it was edited, so we didn't see it.
Yeah.
But as a kid, that would have been completely terrifying.
Yes! Oh my god, yes. Well, I think, let's talk about, like, the practical effects, because for me, the thing that's most remarkable is how much work the music of this film.
Yeah.
There's this iconic and you notice I'm making the Psycho sound.
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
similar.
It very much borrows from that sound, but music is a huge part of what makes that film terrifying.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that music coming in. And again, she doesn't know what the entity is. She's not seeing it. She sometimes gets a sense it's in the room with her. You know, there's the scene with the doctor. Now, I think this is the scene that scared me, is when she's with the Ron Silver character, the doctor, and he's looking at her bruises, and so she has bites on her, and, you know, bruises on her thighs and her ankles, and you can see the handprints on it. I remember that scene being super scary.
Mm.
So I think... because there wasn't CGI at the time, you had to do these practical effects. And so it was almost worse seeing the bites afterwards.
Yes, I think, again, music, practical effects. I think also just the more the existential terror of... I mean, in another way, another comparison to this film, the way that... I don't know if there's much. There's a conflict. I don't know if there's much character development. There is a little bit.
Yeah.
But it's almost, in a way, the way it moves so quickly to the attack, almost like the Conjuring films, which for me are just too much. It's jump scare, jump scare, jump scare, jump scare, jump scare, jump scare, and you're not like, you're aware there's this thing called a plot.
Yeah.
But there's, you know, clapping hands in a dark hallway or something that's so much creepier. There are elements of that with the film too, where it almost sort of overheats. But yeah, there is a real existential. What if some invisible force wanted to kill you?
Yeah.
And how do you stop that? Or harm you?
Well, you know, I think...
in any way.
I think looking at it now, and I know that's not what they... I mean, it's written by a man.
Yeah.
And, like, it's not, you know, necessarily the intention of it. But for me, after watching it, it felt like when women are stuck in a situation where they're being abused and how do you get out of it, and, like, you don't know when it's coming, right? And so that terror of, you know, oh, the day's been fine, I dropped a teacup, now I'm gonna get smacked. And like, that's literally kind of the tension that you have through this film. So for me, in some ways, it's like an interesting exploration of domestic violence and how a person would potentially say, you know, be able to kind of save themselves from that. And she actually never does, right? So the film ends with us understanding that the attacks are
ongoing.
They just
decrease in intensity, yeah.
And which would have been, and I mean, it's even still the case now with domestic violence, but especially at that time, it really wasn't viewed as like much of a crime. Like, oh,
whatever happens behind home doors,
right? If you made a hard bed, you have to sleep in it. Was the adage at that time?
Yeah.
And so for me, I definitely unintentional, but that's what I walked away with, is that feeling of that relentlessness that can come from domestic abuse, and that's what she's experiencing from this unknown entity that is happening. The problem is that gets to me is the whole helium scene is just so bad. Like, the concept of we're going to freeze a ghost with liquid helium. Even demonstrating the liquid helium, they don't wear protective gloves.
yes, they dip a rose and then crush it with their bare hands.
Yeah, they don't use any protective gloves. That concept is so, for me, so lame. Like,
yes,
so
the
lame.
Ending is incredibly lame.
And they rebuild her house in the at UCLA in a gymnasium so that they can control the space, and it's just really, really,
yeah. And there is this interesting, you know, the skepticism but the supernatural,
yeah.
And somehow the people who are supernatural are the most scientific in this film.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very much... I think it's also weird to watch this in 2021.
Yeah.
Where there are some people who believe in any and all alternative theories of reality.
Yeah.
And it's basically the meter of truth is the one that maybe satisfies some need for you.
Yeah.
This movie is the same thing. Psychology and parapsychology, they're the same thing. And if anything... you know, the psychologist is the villain. I was also thinking about how this movie, coming out when it did, was also around the time that Dan Aykroyd was writing Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
The idea that you can contain a ghost.
Yeah.
The idea that you have a bearded, scientifically minded antagonist who tries to actively destroy the ghostbusting operation and putting everyone in extreme danger. That's got the same plot, actually.
Yeah. No, that's actually, I didn't think of it that way, but I think you're absolutely, absolutely right about that. You know, and for me, Ron Silver has always been the low rent Richard Gere.
Yes.
And so, like, you know, Ron Silver, like, if you ever watch, like, Time Cop, he's always kind of in these, like, also ran films that have some notoriety. That's the interesting part about it, too, is that I actually believe he is a psychiatrist at UCLA. Like, he's studying to be a psychiatrist at UCLA.
Yes, he's a resident.
And he, is actually trying to work with her and understand, you know, and they off, you know, there's this actually great scene, we'll talk about it you know, how does it hold up kind of thing. Mm. But there's this great scene where they're all around the table and she's there being interviewed by other psychiatrists and they're trying to figure it out. And she leaves the room and the head of the department goes, oh, it's a masturbation complex.
It's so hard, Freud. It is hard, Freud. It's another one. How many times have we in this podcast discussed these sort of, I half slept through, borrowed my roommate's notes version of Psych 101 that gets invoked in a film.
Yeah.
Here it is again.
Here it is again. Absolutely.
You know, repression, intensity, Freud, yeah. Sexual, grief, whatever.
The sad thing is he's portrayed as the kind of like a villain, and even in some way kind of almost like makes a pass at her.
Yes.
And she's like, I'm not interested in you. Which there's actually nothing that kind of builds up to that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But anyway, but he's like, oh, my patient is in a space that's under all of these things, like canisters of liquid helium. This is probably dangerous. Maybe I need to get her out. Or also she's with a group of people who are, you know, kind of feeding her delusions. Right. Mm-hmm. And so he actually is the good, like, he's actually right. Right. Like he's actually right. And he actually does want her to look at her past. And what we find out is that she was sexually abused, that she married when she was 16, that she
was widowed.
There was probably hints of maybe issues with alcohol. And so he's not wrong that those things have to be explored and understood. And is this connecting back to something that's happening with her? So he's actually portrayed as the bad guy.
Yes, exactly. And as the zealot.
As the zealot.
As the science, you know, the more scientific or traditionally scientific of them is, portrayed as the zealot.
Yeah.
In this film, which again, watching this film now when, you know, people who, you know, go on the Joe Rogan podcast and talk against vaccines are seen as the rational, you know, is interesting, fascinating, and maybe is a signpost to how we got to this point. I guess we should also talk about the, yes, based on a true story. I mean, there is a famous paranormal...
Yeah, if you were into sightings as in the, what, the 90s...
That TV series, yes.
You would have seen that. It was a part of that. It's Doris Bither case, and it came out of... She was in Culver City, California. And so part of the book does... Part of the book, it's the entity is based on a book. And
came out in 1978.
And then this movie. So definitely part of her story is in there. She was being sexually attacked by an unknown entity. She overheard two guys talking in a library, in a bookstore about their work. And that's how she connected with these two parapsychologists who were out of UCLA. And they were there studying this phenomenon with her. The other part of it, like them using the liquid helium, definitely didn't happen. I guess they wanted a dramatic ending.
Yes.
Which actually didn't work anyway in the movie. Yeah. But the thing that...
Oh, temporarily.
Temporarily. But the thing in that we kind of learn about her is... So it is true. So in the movie, she has two daughters and a son. In real life, she had three sons and a daughter. Each one had a different father. She did struggle with alcohol and drugs.
Everything you watch on YouTube or online, you read about it. The house was condemned twice. Somehow somebody found out that fact.
Yeah.
That the house that she lived in was condemned twice.
Yeah.
So you have this person who was on the fringe of society.
On the fringe of society. She also, in her past, was abused. They don't say specifically.
Yeah.
But she definitely was abused in her past. Who has a lot of issues, who's you know, almost getting evicted from her place on multiple occasions. For me, that to condemn twice, that tidbit, and but also you have to think about, like, at one point they say they see sparks. You have to wonder if it's bad wire.
Yeah.
It was condemned. But a haunted woman, like, obviously, yes, a haunted woman. And you get the sense in both film, like the film and in reading about Doris, that haunted, this very, very haunted person. I think the thing that we ended up talking about is the understanding now of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And you do have to wonder if...
And night terrors.
And night terrors. I mean, there's a great documentary all about night terrors. That you have to wonder if she was having post-traumatic stress disorder, or was she having night terrors? And in that, her body, she would have reacted to whatever was the perceived thing that was happening.
Yeah.
And so I think maybe our understanding of psychology, our understanding of trauma has changed over time. And it's not just necessarily a Freudian suppression that's causing you to do these things that I'm masturbating and now things are flying across my room because I'm guilty that I masturbated, right? Like, that was literally in the movie, that's literally the premise of their belief of why that this stuff is happening.
And why her treatment.
And so I think our understanding now of how that works is definitely has evolved. So you do have to wonder if in her past she had been attacked, or even more recently had been attacked, and this was her kind of reaction to this trauma.
Yeah.
And you really have to wonder that. Because you do have to say, unfortunately, you know, with her background with drugs and alcohol and these struggles, is it more believable that she's a victim of all this trauma, and this is the way the trauma is manifesting for her versus this entity, actually multiple entities. When you learn more about the story, she believed there was three different entities in her house doing this to her.
Yeah, and so I think what is also interesting about the film, or maybe where the film suffers a little bit, is that Frank DiFelitta is the person who wrote the novel, who actually, I guess, knew people involved in the case and was kind of...
And interviewed Doris as well.
Interviewed Doris as well. But then also wrote the screenplay. And you wonder sometimes if, especially thinking about that ending with the liquid helium.
Yeah.
And these other ways that the original case kind of works its way into the film in ways that there's, like, baggage almost in the script.
Well, I think they probably know she's an unreliable witness and our narrator. I think they know that. And I think because even we watched on YouTube the sightings episode that had the parapsychologist who investigated, and... he even mentioned, like, oh, I thought she was crazy. She had this background with drugs and alcohol. It seems so crazy. But then I went to her house and there was a stench. But let's be real, if the house has almost been condemned twice...
Who knows what's dead in the walls?
Who knows what's dead in the walls? Or is California what's under the floorboards, right? What's not dead under the floorboards? And then also, probably bad electrical wiring. We lived in a place that had really bad electrical wiring in the basement, and you'd go down there and you would see sparks.
Laundry and sparks and fear of burning to death in the middle of the night.
Right, that we would see that. And so I think even he knows that she is an unreliable witness, and that kind of let's escalate it, let's build this up, like let's make it more than it is. Rather than the true story is it's this frightened woman who is living by herself, who's trying to provide for her children. And whether real or perceived or psychological, there is definitely something that was terrifying her.
Yes, and I think there's also to be said, you know, because the way Barbara Hershey plays her, she's much more legitimate, much more somewhat responsible. The fact that even then, you know, we're only... 2 decades into second wave feminism, there are still not a lot of spaces for women and not a lot of spaces for single mothers in the culture. And you think we're 15 years before, or 10, 15 years before, you know, the first Bush basically campaigning on the fact that single mothers are the downfall of society.
Right. And of course she has children with each child has a different father.
Yeah, so it's all wrapped up in that.
And so you have to wonder, you know, like Doris unfortunately died in her 50s, and so you don't have the full story. Her one son did say that he saw her being attacked and he was pushed by an entity, but you have to wonder, in her flailing, did she knock him?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is this lingering doubt, which, yeah. Again, I think the movie picks its card and says, yes, we're going with the supernatural, and we're legitimizing the supernatural, which is what it is.
Yeah.
Is it time for the big four questions?
Yeah, let's go for
it. Or the four big questions?
Yeah.
First one is it camp retro classic or just an old movie?
I don't know. What do you say?
I think just an old movie. Yeah. I think it's something... again, it's something I wonder if a younger viewer who wasn't frightened by this movie as, like, a six-year-old...
Yeah.
You know, what their feelings about the film would be. There is... you know, the plot's a little clunky.
Yeah.
The exhibition's a little quick. The music is really good.
Yeah.
But... I don't know if a younger person would, or even someone our age, someone who's a little old, or someone who's a little older, it's like, yeah, you put this movie up against Poltergeist, and
the sad thing is, like, the ending of, like, the whole confrontation scene in Poltergeist actually feels more, like, realistic than this confrontation scene with the entity, which is sad.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a classic film. I mean, that ending for me borders slightly on campy, but I do feel... Yeah. I agree with you. I just think it's an old film.
It's an old film. I mean, it's an entertaining old film. Yeah. I think it's an interesting exercise in style. I mean, I was even thinking about that first 10 minutes of the film, or that first sequence of the film, was the title sequence, as if you wanted to teach exhibition in... in any sort of creative writing fiction class or a film class. I mean, the iconography of her, the car, the night class, the way she's late to the night class but still hustles, the condition the house is in, all of it is so brutally efficient of how you can just kind of symbolically say, this is where this person is. It does that really well. It does scary music really well.
Yeah. There's actually... when she first comes home, she checks on her two younger children, and you actually think they're home alone. And it's not until she goes to the garage that you see that there's the 18-year-old son.
Yeah.
Which is, like, they actually have this kind of, like, weird...
Yeah, I didn't realize at first. I forgot. For a second there, I thought, I was like, oh, her boyfriend or her husband's in the thing. And I was like, no, that's the... son. When he says mom, I was like,
Yeah, there's like this kind of weird...
but dynamic that you're not sure how to play it,
But it is just an old film.
It's an old film. Question two, then, being an old film, what about the social political distance?
So one of the funniest ones to me is the scene where all the psychiatrists are interviewing.
They are all smoking. back in the glory days when you could smoke in hospitals.
Yeah.
This movie, there's smoking in hospitals. There's smoking college campuses. There's the group therapy session where all of the doctors are smoking. So you get that. But I think to circle back around to the thinking about the Barbara Hershey character, in the way that there is character development, is that she starts out as this fiercely independent woman who's trying to make things work, even if her efforts are imperfect.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, she finally, like, stands up to the entity. She is saying, I'm not scared anymore. I'm not going to... So that way, she is this oddly progressive character.
Yeah.
The film does pass the Bechdel test.
Yeah.
The two women, her and her best friend, do help each other out, do have conversations with each other that's not about a man.
Yeah.
You know? In fact, if anything, her best friend, who is married to a kind of a lug... envies the Barbara Hershey character's singleness and says, I should probably divorce him. I should probably, claim my liberation. And so in that way, it is interesting that you have, and again, is that part of why the film is somewhat forgotten, is that you had a strong female lead.
Yeah.
And there really isn't a male savior. In fact, the head of the parapsychology department is also female in this film.
Yeah, and she does have a boyfriend who you only see twice, and he's the guy from The Godfather who has the horse head in his bed.
Yes.
That's the first thing I saw. I'm like, the horse head guy. Rocco is his last name. he's her absentee boyfriend. He's a traveling salesman, which, again, is really dated. You don't really have traveling salesmen anymore. So she does have a boyfriend, but when he realizes what's happening, he witnesses the attack, he leaves.
Yeah, he bails. I can handle anything but this.
And the Ron Silver character, the psychiatrist, does try to be her savior, and she literally tells him, I'm not interested.
Yes.
He says, you know, I want you, hints at that he wants a relationship with her and wants to take her away from this, and she just says, I'm not interested. I don't want that connection.
And in the end, she, I mean, literally kind of drives off into the sunset.
Yeah.
They leave the house. I mean, there is this interesting final scene.
Yeah.
Where the house is empty. She's about to leave. The entity tries to keep her there.
Yeah.
And she just goes over and unlocks the door and walks out.
Yeah. And it says, welcome home. Yeah.
Yeah.
But there is, at the end, as she's driving away, there's a little postscript saying that, you know, they continued, but the frequency and...
intensity has diminished.
So that is interesting. I think that is correct. That is interesting. The other big thing about it is our understanding of mental health is really
different,
very dated in that film. Freud was definitely very popular at the time, and I think, not that I like some of the.
Freud, he opens a door.
He opens a door.
This is the thing about Freud, right?
Yeah.
He opens a door, but the fact that you have a dozen or so clients in one city in one era of human history is not a universal theory of human personality. But he opens a door then generations later have come
instead of it being your humors are off or you need bloodletting, he was the one to start.
Well, you know, and the other part of it is, I will say about Freud, it's in the Norton Anthology of Literary Theory, because in English studies, actually, in literature studies and in film studies, Freud is still popular and legitimate.
Yeah.
More so than psychology. But in that essay, in that introduction to Freud, it makes the argument that the real contribution of Freud in the history of the Western mind is that Freud took reason from, instead of being the master of the house, to just being this precarious defense mechanism in the human psyche. World's never been the same after that. That part of Freud is still with us very much.
Well, I also think the thing of, like, the subconscious and that, you know, that we do make choices that sometimes we don't even understand, right? And I think that kind of... But anyway, we got off on a tangent.
Yes.
But, you know, definitely Freud was very popular at the time. And then if you, like, you know, archetypes, Jungian archetypes, the entity is definitely a Jungian archetype.
Jungian thing,
and so we do have to mention that's there. But I think in overall, as we discussed earlier, like, you know, was this a woman who had post-traumatic stress disorder? Was she bipolar? Was she schizophrenic? And they just didn't understand her mental health issues.
Yes.
And then her meeting the parapsychologist, feeding into those delusions. Now, I love a good ghost story. I love sightings as a child. I love, love, love ghost stories. But you do have to... question this kind of ghost story, and I think that kind of understanding, and I wish that they had done a better balance of the two, of because they did go right away to believing her, and I so there wasn't this nice balance of, like, is it in her mind, is it a psychological issue, or is it a paranormal issue. I wish they did a better job of balancing that tension in that film. I think that would have been helpful to see.
Yes. So the technical distance, I guess, again, a practical effects movie.
Yeah.
The ending is very cheesy. The ending when the entity is briefly trapped in the frozen nitrogen, which the entity explodes
on
itself.
Frozen
helium explodes on itself.
Yeah.
Which is also strange, but then breaks its way out of.
Well, also, like, it's just a blob, so it's not even a human figure that you're like,
yes,
it was a demon or something like that.
No, it's a blob. It's an ice blob.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of...
I do think the practical effects, except for that part, were relatively
good. Yeah, I mean, even the scene also where the entity attacks her in a car as she's driving, and she can't control the car. That the jump cuts, the cutaways in that sequence are brilliant. So that it works. I think in a weird way it doesn't. It's not as dated as some early CGI films that came 20 years later.
Right.
So is it a keeper? Question four.
I think it's an interesting film. I do think it's a keeper. I just don't think it's as good as Poltergeist or The Changeling.
Watch the Poltergeist. Watch The Changeling. If you want practical effects, atmospheric, haunted house horror, watch The Changeling first.
Yes.
The George C. Scott Changeling first.
Yeah.
And then if you want something a little more over the top and campy, watch Amityville Horror. Then get yourself pure Gen X generational narcissism. Watch the, 82 Poltergeist. And then if you still got room in your heart, check out The Entity. Or if you're like me, you watched that film again when you were 6 years old and it terrified you and traumatized you. And you want to revisit and feel the magic all over again. All right.
But there's definitely a lot better films that you could watch before.
From this era. Though Barbara Hershey is great.
Barbara Hershey does an amazing job. And as a horror completist, as a person who likes to watch as much as possible, I do think it was important to watch this film. But again, there's a lot of films that do it better. I adore Poltergeist as well. I think that was another one that I watched really young, and it's
way too young.
It scared me at the time. But even watching it now that I'm older, that kind of family dynamic is done really, really, really well.
We're going to have to do Poltergeist at some point.
We'll have to do Poltergeist at some point.
Now we have that on VHS.
I'm pretty positive it's in a silver case.
Yeah.
I think we have Poltergeist. But I would keep it. I think it, in that kind of domestic horror oeuvre, it has a space. I would keep it. How about you?
I would keep it. I agree with all of that. And again, I think the strength of the female lead does make this an oddly progressive film, or at least a film that is, there's elements of this film that are dated, but there's also maybe elements of the film that are really ahead of their time. Hmm. And so I'd keep it. And also the nostalgia factor for me is why I picked it out of a garage full of VHS tapes. And on that happy note, guess that's it.
Bye.
Bye.